confession. Said he killed Judge Fawcett because the judge reneged on a bribe. Said he, the gang, paid $500,000 cash to Fawcett for a favorable ruling on the motion to suppress the search that yielded a van load of coke. Westlake paused and watched Jimmy Lee carefully. Jimmy Lee's eyes yielded nothing. He finally shrugged and said, So did you have any knowledge of this bribe?
If I knew about it, then that would be a crime, wouldn't it? You think I'm stupid enough to admit to a crime? I'm offended.
Oh, don't be offended, Mr. Arnold. I'm not accusing you of anything.
Did Quinn Rucker implicate me in the bribe?
He's been vague so far. Said only that a lawyer was the intermediary.
I'm sure this particular gang of thugs has access to a lot of lawyers.
Indeed. Were you surprised when Judge Fawcett denied the motion to suppress? Jimmy Lee smiled and rolled his eyes.
Nothing surprises me anymore. If you believe in the Constitution, then it was a bad search and the evidence, 150 kilos of pure coke, should have been kicked out.
That would take some spine. And you don't see much of that anymore, especially in big drug busts. It takes balls for a judge, state or federal, to exclude such wonderful evidence, regardless of what the cops did to get it.
No, I wasn't surprised.
How long did you practice in Judge Fawcett's courtroom?
Since the day he was appointed, 20 years ago. I knew him well.
Do you believe he would take a bribe?
A cash bribe for a favorable ruling?
And a lighter sentence. Jimmy Lee crossed his legs, hanging one ostrich skin boot on a knee, and locked his hands together just below his gut. He thought for a moment, then said,
I've seen judges make some outrageous decisions, but usually out of stupidity or laziness. But no, Mr. Westlake, I do not believe Judge Fawcett or any other state or federal judge within the Commonwealth of Virginia would take a bribe, cash or otherwise. I said nothing surprises me, but I was wrong. Such a bribe would shock me.
Would you say Judge Fawcett had a reputation for high integrity?
No, I wouldn't say that. He was okay his first few years on the bench. Then he changed and became a real hard ass. My clients have all been charged with crimes, but they're not all criminals. Fawcett didn't see it that way. He was much too happy to send a guy away for 20 years. He always sided with the prosecution and the cops, and to me, that's not integrity.
But he didn't take money.
Not to my knowledge.
Here's our quandary, Mr. Arnold. If Quinn Rucker is telling the truth, then how did he manage to get the money to Fawcett? Here's a tough street kid from D.C. who's never met Fawcett before. There had to be an intermediary somewhere along the line. I'm not saying it's you, and there's no suggestion that you're involved in his story. But you know the system. How did the $500,000 change hands? Jimmy Lee was shaking his head.
If the system involves bribery, then I don't know how it works, okay? I resent the implication. You're talking to the wrong man.
Again, I'm not implicating or accusing you of anything.
You're getting pretty damn close.
Jimmy Lee slowly got to his feet and reached for the recorder.
Let's say this little meeting is over.
No need for that, Mr. Arnold. Jimmy Lee picked up the recorder and returned it to a pocket.
It's been a real pleasure, he said,
as he yanked open the door and disappeared down the hall. Directly across Church Street, D. Ray Rucker was entering another law office as Victor Westlake and his agents left Jimmy Lee's. Quinn had been arrested the previous Wednesday night and had spent the first 10 hours of his captivity in the interrogation room. After he confessed on camera, he was finally taken to the Norfolk City Jail, placed in solitary, and slept for 12 straight hours. He was not allowed to use the phone until Saturday morning, and it took most of the day to reach a family member who was willing to talk. Early Saturday evening, Quinn was driven from Norfolk to Roanoke, a 4.5-hour journey. Once D-Ray realized his older brother was in jail for killing a federal judge, he scrambled to find a lawyer who would take the case. Several in D.C. and Virginia declined. By late Sunday afternoon, another Roanoke character named Dusty Shiver had agreed to represent Quinn through the initial stages of the prosecution, but he reserved the right to step down if a trial became imminent. For obvious reasons, the local bar was more than a little nervous about representing a man charged with knocking off such an important part of the judiciary. Dusty Shiver had once practiced law with Jimmy Lee Arnold, and they were cut from the same mold. In law, most partnerships, large and small, blow up, usually over the issue of money. Jimmy Lee got stiffed on a fee, blamed his partners, and moved across the street. Dusty had managed to spend an hour with Quinn at the jail early Monday morning, before the indictment was announced. He was surprised to learn his client had already confessed. Quinn was adamant that he was coerced, tricked, pressured, threatened, and that the confession was bogus. He was claiming to be innocent. After leaving the jail, Dusty stopped by the U.S. Attorney's office and picked up a copy of the indictment. He was poring over it when his secretary buzzed in with the report that Mr. D. Ray Rucker had arrived. Of the two, Dusty, with long gray hair, faded jeans, and a red leather vest, looked more like a drug trafficker, and D. Ray, in a Xenia suit, looked more like a lawyer. They greeted each other cautiously in Dusty's cluttered office. The first issue was the retainer, and D. Ray opened his Prada attaché and produced $50,000 in cash, which Dusty counted and stuck in a drawer.
"Do you know he's already confessed?" Dusty asked as he tucked the money away.
"He what?"
asked D. Ray, shocked.
"Yes, he's confessed. He says he signed a written statement admitting to the murders, and supposedly there's also a video. Please tell me he's too smart for that."
"He's too smart for that. We never talk to cops. Never. Quinn would not voluntarily confess to anything, even if he was dead guilty. That's not our M.O. If a cop shows up, we start calling lawyers. He says the interrogation lasted all night long. He waived his rights, asked for a lawyer several times, but the two FBI agents kept hammering away. They tripped him up, got him confused, and he began hallucinating. He couldn't shut up. They said he was facing 2 counts of capital murder and that the entire family would be indicted since the killings were a part of gang business. They lied to him and said they could help him if he cooperated, that the family of Judge Fawcett was opposed to the death penalty, and so on. After hours of this, they broke him and he gave them what they wanted. Says he doesn't remember all that happened. He was too fatigued. When he woke up and tried to recall what had happened, it was all a dream, a nightmare. It took several hours before he realized what he had done. But even now he can't remember everything."
D. Ray listened, too stunned to speak. Dusty continued.
"He does remember the FBI agents telling him that they have a ballistics report that matches one of his guns to the crime scene, and there is supposedly a boot print of some sort. Plus, there are witnesses who place him in the vicinity at the time of the murders. Again, some of this is vague."
"When can you see the confession?"
"I'll meet with the U.S. attorney as soon as possible, but nothing will happen fast. It might be weeks before I see a written confession and the video.
as well as the other evidence they plan to use. If he asked for a lawyer, why didn't they stop the interrogation?
That's a great question. Usually, though, the cops will swear that the defendant waived his rights and did not ask for a lawyer. His word against theirs. In a case this important, you can bet the FBI agents will swear to hell and back that Quinn never mentioned a lawyer. Just like they'll swear they did not threaten him, or lie to him, or promise him a deal. They got their confession. Now they're trying to build a case with physical evidence. If they find nothing, then the confession is all they have.
Is it enough?
Oh, yes.
I don't believe this. Quinn's not stupid. He would never agree to an interrogation.
Has he ever killed anyone before?
Not that I know of. We have other people who do that sort of thing.
Why did he escape from prison?
You ever been to prison?
No.
Neither have I. But I know lots of guys who've served time. Everybody wants out.
I suppose, Shiver said.
You ever heard of a guy named Malcolm Bannister?
No.
Quinn says they served time together at Frostburg, and that he's the guy who's behind these accusations. Says he and Bannister were friends and talked at length about Judge Fawcett and his dirty work. He's really bitter at Bannister.
When can I see my brother?
Not until Saturday, regular visitation. I'll go back to the jail this afternoon with a copy of the indictment. I can pass along any messages if you'd like.
Sure. Tell him to keep his mouth shut.
I'm afraid it's too late for that.
Chapter 20. The details are vague and unlikely to become clearer. Pat Suroff is willing to tell me that the clinic is a part of the U.S. Army Hospital at Fort Carson, but that would be hard to deny. He cautiously says that the clinic specializes in RAM, Radical Appearance Modification, and is used by several agencies of the federal government. The plastic surgeons are some of the best and have worked on a lot of faces that might otherwise get blown off if not radically modified. I grill him just to watch him squirm, but he does not divulge much else. After my surgery, I will convalesce here for 2 months before moving on. My first appointment is with a therapist of some variety who wants to make sure I'm ready for the jolting experience of changing not only names, but faces as well. She's pleasant and thoughtful, and I easily convince her that I'm eager to move on. The second meeting is with two doctors, both male, and a female nurse. The woman is needed for the feminine perspective of how I will look afterward. It doesn't take me long to realize that these three are very good at what they do. Using sophisticated software, they are able to take my face and make almost any change. The eyes are crucial here, they say more than once. Change the eyes, and you change everything. Sharpen the nose a bit. Leave the lips alone. Some Botox in the folds of the cheek should work. Definitely shave the head and keep it that way. For almost 2 hours, we fiddle and tinker with the new face of Max Baldwin. In the hands of less experienced surgeons, this might be a gut-wrenching experience. For the past 25 years, all of my adult life, I have looked basically the same. My face shaped by genetics, weathered by the years, and, luckily, unblemished by wounds or injuries. It's a nice, solid face that served me well, and to suddenly ditch it forever is no small step. My new friends say there is no need to change anything, only a few ways to improve. A nip here, a tuck there, a bit of tightening and straightening, and voila, a new version that's every bit as handsome and much safer. I assure them I'm much more concerned with safety than vanity,
and they readily agree. They've heard this before. I cannot help but wonder how many informants, snitches, and spies they've worked on. Hundreds, judging by their teamwork. As my new look comes together on the large computer screen, we have serious discussions about accessories, and the three seem genuinely excited when a pair of round, tortoiseshell glasses is placed on Max's face.
"That's it,"
the nurse says excitedly. And I have to admit, Max looks a lot smarter and hipper. We spend an entire half hour playing around with various mustache schemes before tossing the idea altogether. We split 2-2 on the idea of a beard, then decide to just wait and see. I promise not to shave for a week, so we'll have a better idea. Because of the gravity of what we're doing, my little team is in no hurry. We spend the entire morning redesigning Max, and when everyone is happy, they print a high-definition rendering of my new look. I take it with me back to my room and tack it to the wall. A nurse studies it and says she likes it. I like her too, but she's married and does not flirt. If she only knew. I pass the afternoon reading and walking around the unrestricted areas of the base. It's much like killing time at Frostburg, a place far away in both distance and memory. I keep coming back to my room, to the face on the wall. A slick head, slightly pointed nose, slightly enhanced chin, leaner cheeks, no wrinkles, and the eyes of someone new. The middle-aged puffiness is gone. The eyelids are not quite as large. Most important, Max is staring through a pair of round designer frames, and he looks pretty damned hip. I'm assuming it's just that easy, that these doctors can deliver a face that looks exactly like Max on the wall. But even if they get close, I'll be pleased. No one will recognize their new creation, and that's all that matters. I'm too close to judge whether I'll look better before or after. But the truth is that I'll look good enough. Safety is indeed far more important than vanity. At 7 the next morning, they prep me and roll me into a small operating room. The anesthesiologist goes through his routine, and I happily float away. The operation lasts for 5 hours and is a great success, according to the doctors. They have no way of knowing because my face is wrapped like a mummy's. It will be weeks before the swelling is all gone and the new features take shape. 4 days after he was indicted, Quinn Rucker made his initial appearance in court. For the occasion, he was kept in the same orange jumpsuit he'd been wearing since his arrival at the Roanoke City Jail. He was handcuffed and chained to his waist, and his ankles were bound and chained. A bulletproof vest was strapped over his shoulders and around his midsection, and no fewer than a dozen heavily armed guards, agents, and deputies escorted him out of the jail and into a bulletproof Chevrolet Suburban. No threats had been made on his life, and a secret route would be taken to the federal courthouse, but the authorities were taking no chances. Inside the courtroom, reporters and onlookers filled the seats long before Rucker's scheduled appearance at 10 a.m. His arrest and indictment were big news, with no intervening mass murder or celebrity breakup to steal his thunder. Outside the courtroom, the bindings and armor were removed, and Quinn entered unshackled. As the only participant in an orange jumpsuit, and virtually the only black guy in the courtroom, Quinn certainly looked guilty. He sat at a table with Dusty Shiver and one of his associates. Across the aisle, Stanley Mumphrey and his brigade of assistants pushed files around with great importance, as if preparing to argue before the Supreme Court. Out of respect to their fallen comrade, The other 11 judges in the Southern District had recused themselves from the case. The initial appearance would be in front of Ken Conover, a U.S. magistrate, who would look and act very much like a presiding judge. Conover took the bench and called things to order. He rattled off a few preliminaries, then asked if the defendant had read the indictment.
"He has," Dusty responded, "and we waive a formal reading."
"Thank you," replied Conover. Seated in the first row behind the defense table was D-Ray, fashionably dressed as always, and obviously concerned. Conover said,
"Does the defendant wish to enter a plea at this time?"
On cue, Dusty stood and nodded at his client, who likewise got to his feet awkwardly and said,
"Yes, sir. Not guilty."
"Very well. A plea of not guilty is hereby entered."
Dusty and Quinn sat down. Conover said,
"I have here a motion to set bail, Mr. Shiver. Do you want to be heard on this?"
His tone left no doubt that nothing Dusty could say would persuade the court to grant a reasonable bail, if any. Sensing the inevitable, and wishing not to embarrass himself, Dusty said,
"No, Your Honor. The motion speaks for itself."
"Mr. Mumphrey."
Stanley stood and walked to the podium. He cleared his throat and said,
"Your Honor, this defendant has been indicted for the murder of a federal judge. The United States feels strongly that he should be held without bail."
"I agree," Conover said quickly. "Anything further, Mr. Mumphrey?"
"No, sir. Not at this time."
"Mr. Shiver?"
"No, Your Honor."
"The defendant shall be remanded to the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service."
Conover tapped his gavel, stood, and left the bench. The initial appearance lasted less than 10 minutes. D-Ray had been in Roanoke for 3 days and was tired of the place. He leaned on Dusty Shiver, who leaned on a friend at the jail, and a quick meeting was arranged with the accused. Since visits with the family were on weekends only, this one would take place off the record, in a room used to test drunk drivers for blood alcohol content. No record of it would ever be entered. The brothers did not suspect anyone was listening. The FBI recorded their conversation, a portion of it being, "Quinn,
I'm here because of Malcolm Bannister, D. You understand what I'm saying?"
D-Ray,
"I got it. I got it. And we'll deal with it later. Right now, you gotta tell me what happened."
"Quinn, nothing happened. I didn't kill nobody. They tricked me into the confession, like I said. I want something done about Bannister."
D-Ray,
"He's in prison, right?"
Quinn,
"Probably not. Knowing Bannister, he probably used Rule 35 to get out."
D-Ray, "Rule 35? Quinn,
"Everybody on the inside knows Rule 35. Ain't important now. He's out, and he needs to be found."
A long pause. D-Ray,
"Lot of time. Lot of money."
Quinn,
"Look, little brother, don't tell me about time. The Fibbies got nothing on me. I mean nothing. That don't mean they can't nail my ass. If this thing goes to trial in a year or so, Bannister might be their star witness. Hear what I'm saying?"
D-Ray,
And what's he gonna say?
Quinn.
He'll say whatever it takes. He don't care. He's out, man. He cut the deal. He'll say we talked about Judge Fawcett back in prison. That's what he'll say.
D-Ray.
Did you?
Another long pause.
Quinn.
Yeah. We talked about him all the time. We knew he kept cash.
A pause.
Quinn.
You gotta get Bannister, D-Ray. Okay?
D-Ray.
Okay.
Let me talk to Tall Man.
Chapter 21. 3 weeks post-surgery, and I'm climbing the walls. The bandages are off and the stitches are gone, but the swelling is taking forever. I look in the mirror 100 times a day, waiting for things to improve, waiting for Max to emerge from the bruising and puffiness. My surgical team stops by constantly to tell me how great I look, but I'm sick of these people. I can't chew, can't eat, can't walk for more than 5 minutes, and so most of my time is spent rolling around in a wheelchair. Movements must be slow and calculated. Otherwise, I could rip out some of the fine artwork that has gone into the face of Max Reed Baldwin. I count the days and often think I'm in prison again. Weeks pass, and the swelling and bruising slowly go away. Is it possible to be in love with a woman you've never actually touched? I have convinced myself the answer is yes. Her name is Vanessa Young, and I met her at Frostburg in the visitor's room on a cold, wintry Saturday morning. I shouldn't say that I met her, but I saw her for the first time. She was there visiting her brother, a guy I knew and liked. We met later during another visit, but we couldn't touch. I wrote her letters and she wrote a few back, but it became painfully obvious, at least to me, that my infatuation with Vanessa was not exactly a two-way street. I cannot begin to contemplate the hours I've invested fantasizing about this woman. Over the past 2 years, our lives have changed dramatically. And now I am emboldened to contact her. My new best friend, Pat Suroff, informed me that I cannot write or receive letters while at Fort Carson. But I write one anyway. I work on it for days, tweaking, editing, killing time. I bare my soul to Vanessa and practically beg her to see me. I'll find a way to mail it later. Suroff is back to fetch me. We leave Fort Carson in a hurry and drive to Denver, where we board a nonstop flight to Atlanta. I wear a baseball cap and big sunglasses, and I do not catch a single curious glance. I bitch about the seating arrangement. We're sitting side by side in coach, not first class. Pat says Congress is cutting budgets everywhere. After a hearty lunch of raisins and cokes, we get down to business. He opens a delightful little file with all sorts of goodies. A Virginia court order changing my name to Max Reed Baldwin, a new Social Security card issued to the same guy, a birth certificate proving I was born in Memphis to parents I've never heard of, and a Florida driver's license with a fake photo taken from the computerized rendering my doctors and I concocted before the surgery. It looks so real that not even I can tell it's fake. Pat explains that I'll get another in a month or so when my face finally comes together. Same for a passport. We fill out applications for Visa and American Express cards. At his suggestion, I've been practicing a different handwriting, one that resembles chicken scratch but is not much worse than the old one. Max signs a 6-month lease for a 1-bedroom condo in Neptune Beach, a few miles east of Jacksonville, and he applies for a checking account at Suncoast Bank. Pat tells me there's a branch office 3 blocks from the condo. The reward money of $150,000 will be wired into the account as soon as it's up and running, and from there, I can do with it what I want. Because I will hit the ground with so much cash, the powers that be feel as though I don't need much from them. I really can't gripe about this. He says the IRS will grant me a waiver from any taxes on the money and provides the name of an accountant who knows both the IRS code and whatever code the marshals use. He hands me an envelope with $3,000 in cash and says this should be enough to get me plugged in. We talk about the ins and outs of leasing a car as opposed to buying one, and he explains that a lease is easier and will help build a good credit rating. He hands me a 2-page summary of the life of Max Baldwin, and it reads like an obituary. Parents, siblings, education, employment history, and I'm intrigued to know that I've spent most of my life in Seattle and have been divorced twice. No children. I'm relocating to Florida because it's about as far away from wife number 2 as I can get. It's important for me to memorize this fiction and stick with the script. I have an employment history, all with government agencies, and a credit score. On the issue of employment, I have 2 choices. The first is that of a procurement officer at the Mayport Naval Station, a few miles north of Neptune Beach, starting salary of $48,000, 2 months of training required. The second is that of an account manager for the Veterans Administration, also at $48,000 a year. It's best if I remain a federal employee, at least for the first few years. However, Pat stresses for the 10th time, my life now belongs to me, and I can do whatever I want. The only boundaries are those dictated by my past. Just as I begin to feel somewhat overwhelmed, he reaches into his briefcase and pulls out the toys. The first is an Apple iPad, mine courtesy of the government, and already registered to Max. As the librarian, Malcolm had access to computers, but not the internet, and I worked hard to keep my skills as fresh as possible. But this thing blows me away. We spend a full hour in an intense tutorial. When I'm exhausted, he pulls out an iPhone. It's his, not mine, because I'll have to select a service provider and buy my own phone. But he walks me through this amazing device. The flight is over before we can finish. I find a computer store in the Atlanta airport, and I kill an hour browsing through the gadgets. Technology will be the key to my survival, and I am determined to know the latest. Before we leave Atlanta, I mail the letter to Vanessa Young. No return address. We land in Jacksonville at dark, rent a car, and drive 30 minutes to the beaches east of the city. Atlantic Beach, Neptune Beach, Jacksonville Beach. You can't tell where one ends and the other begins. It's a cool area with hundreds of neat cottages, some residential, some rentals, and assorted small hotels and modern condos facing the ocean. The raisins for lunch are long forgotten, and we are starving. We find a seafood place on a pedestrian mall a block from the water and devour oysters and shrimp. It's a young crowd at the bar, lots of pretty girls with tanned legs, and I can't help but stare. So far, everyone is white, and I wonder if I'll stand out. The Jacksonville metro area has 1 million people, and 18% of them are black, so Pat does not think my ethnicity will be a problem. I attempt to explain what it's like being black in a white world, but realize, again, that some things cannot be fully covered over dinner, if ever. I change the subject and ask questions about the witness security program. Pat is based in Virginia and will soon return home. Another marshal will become my contact, my handler, and this person will not in any way attempt to keep me under surveillance. He or she will always be close by in case of problems or trouble. Typically, my handler will have several other persons to monitor. If there is a hint of something gone wrong, I will be moved at once to another location. But, Pat assures me, this rarely happens. What will it take for the bad guys to find me? Pat says he doesn't know, because this has never happened. I press him. But surely you've had to relocate some people. I've never been involved in a relocation, but yes, it has happened. To my knowledge, and I've been handling informants for 10 years, there has not been a serious threat against one. But I've heard of a couple, maybe three, who became convinced they had been discovered. They wanted to move, so we swooped in and they vanished again. For obvious reasons, neither the law library nor the general library at Frostburg offered books on witness protection, so my knowledge is limited. But I know the program has not been perfect. So, no problems whatsoever? That's hard to believe. I didn't say it was perfect. There's a great story from 30 years ago, a legend in the business. We had a serious mafia informant who squealed on the family and took down some big bosses, one of the FBI's biggest grand slams ever. This guy had a bullseye on him you could hit blindfolded. We took him deep, buried him, and a few years passed. He was a postal inspector in a town of 50,000. Perfect cover. But he was a crook, right? A thug by birth, and it was impossible for him to stay clean. He opened a used car lot, then another. He got into the pawn shop business, started fencing stolen goods, and eventually found his way into the marijuana trade. We knew who he was, but the FBI did not. When he got indicted, he called his handler to come bail him out of jail. The handler freaked out, as did everyone along the ladder, all the way up to the director of the FBI. There was a mad scramble to get him out of jail and off to a new location. Jobs were threatened, deals were cut, judges were pleaded with, and they eventually got his charges dismissed. But it was a close call. So don't start laundering money again. He thinks his last comment is funny. I've never laundered money, I say without a smile. Sorry. We finish dessert and head for my new home. It's on the 7th floor of a tower, one of 4 in a cluster lined up along the beach, with tennis courts and pools scattered below. Pat explains that most of the units are rentals, but a few have permanent residents. I'm here for 6 months, and then it's up to me. It's a 1-bedroom unit, furnished, with a kitchen-den combo. Nice sofa and chairs. Nothing luxurious, but not cheap either. After he's gone, I stand on my small balcony and stare at the moon over the ocean. I breathe the salty air and listen to the waves gently roll ashore. Freedom is exhilarating and indescribable. I forgot to close the curtains, and I wake up to a blinding sun. It is my first true morning as a liberated and unwatched person, and I can't wait to feel sand between my toes. There are a few early birds on the beach, and I hustle down there, my face partially hidden behind a cap and sunglasses. No one notices. No one cares. People who roam aimlessly up and down beaches are lost in their own worlds, and I am quickly getting lost in mine. I have no family, no job, no responsibilities, and no past. Max is starting a brand new life. Pat Suroff retrieves me around noon, and we have a sandwich for lunch. Then he drives me to the Mayport Naval Station, where I have an appointment with the doctor who knows the code. The surgery is progressing nicely. No complications whatsoever. I'll return in 2 weeks for another exam. Next, we go to the Suncoast Bank branch near the condo. And as we get close, Pat preps me for what's coming. He will not go inside, because it's important for me to establish the account myself. No one in the bank knows the code. It's strictly above board. For the time being, Max Baldwin is semi-retired, not working, and pondering a move to the area. He wants to open a standard checking account, no frills, and so on, and will put down $1,000 cash as the initial deposit. Once the account is opened, Max will return to the bank and get the proper wiring instructions. Inside the bank, I am routed to the lovely Gretchen Heiler, a 40-ish bleached blonde who spent far too much time in the sun. She has a small desk in a tight cubicle and no wedding ring. She has no way of knowing that she is the first woman I've been truly alone with in over 5 years. Try as I do, I cannot stop a lot of improper thoughts. Or maybe they're just natural. Gretchen is a chatterbox, and at this moment, so am I. We go through the paperwork quickly, with me proudly giving a real address. I put down $1,000 in cash. She fetches some temporary checks and promises more in the mail later. When all business has ended, we keep talking. She gives me her card and is willing to help in any way. I promise to call when I get a cell phone. The bank needs a phone number. I almost ask her to dinner, primarily because I'm convinced she might say yes, but I wisely let it pass. There will be plenty of time for that later, after I'm more comfortable and my face is easier to look at, hopefully. I proposed to Dion when I was 24 years old, and from that moment until the day I was sentenced and taken into custody, I was never unfaithful. There was one near miss, with the wife of an acquaintance, but we both realized things would end badly. As a small-town lawyer, I saw a lot of divorces, and I was constantly amazed at the awful ways men could screw up their lives and families simply because they couldn't resist temptation. A quickie, then a casual fling, then something more serious, and before long they were in court getting their eyeballs clawed out and losing their kids, along with their money. The truth was, I adored my wife, and I was getting all the sex I wanted at home. The other part of the truth was that I never fancied myself as a ladies' man. Before Dion, I had girlfriends and enjoyed my single days, but I never hopped blindly from one bed to another. Now, 43 and single, I have a hunch there are a lot of women around my age who are looking for companionship. I can feel the urge, but at the same time, all movements must be calculated. As I walk out of the bank, I feel a sense of accomplishment. I just pulled off the first little mission of my secret existence. Pat has been waiting in the car, and when I get in, he says,
"Well,
no problem.
What took so long?"
"The account manager is a cute girl, and she threw herself at me."
"Has this always been a problem?"
"I wouldn't call it a problem, but yes, women are attracted to me. I've always had to fight them off with a stick."
"Keep fighting. It's been the downfall of many men."
"So you're an expert on women?"
"Not at all."
"Where are we going now?"
"Shopping.
I want some decent clothes." We find a men's store, and I spend $800 upgrading my wardrobe. Once again, Pat waits in the car. We agree that two men, both in their early 40s, one white and the other black, shopping together, might raise an eyebrow or two. My goal is to raise as few eyebrows as possible. Next, he drops me off at a Florida Cellular office where I open an account and buy an iPhone. With it in my pocket, I finally feel like a real American, connected. We spend the next 2 days running errands and getting Max firmly established. I write my first check to a car leasing agency and drive away in a used Audi A4 convertible, mine for the next 12 months at $400 a pop and fully insured. Now that I'm mobile, and now that Pat and I are getting on each other's nerves, he starts talking about his exit. I'm ready for the independence, and he's ready to go home. I visit Gretchen again to check on the bank's wiring instructions and explain to her that a substantial sum of money is on the way. Pat clears things with his higher-ups, and the reward money is moved from some buried account to Suncoast. I assume that everybody involved in the wire transfer invokes all the standard precautions. I have no way of knowing the wire is being watched. Chapter 22. Dusty Shiver's motion to suppress the confession was not at all unexpected. It was lengthy, well-written, well-reasoned, and backed up by a 30-page affidavit signed by Quinn Rucker, in which he fully recanted his confession. 3 days after it was filed, Victor Westlake and two of his agents met with Stanley Mumphrey and two of his assistants. Their goal was to plow through the motion and prepare responses to it. Neither Mumphrey nor anyone else in his office was aware of the interrogation tactics used by agents Pankovitz and DeLock. Nor did they know that Westlake and four of his men had watched by closed circuit the 10-hour marathon and had a tape of it. This information would never be revealed to the U.S. attorney. Thus, it would never be known to the defense, the judge, or anyone else. Stanley had been fully briefed by his lieutenants and took control of the meeting. He began by saying, "The first and most important issue is the allegation that the defendant wanted to talk to a lawyer." Westlake nodded to an agent who whipped out some papers. Westlake said, "We have here two affidavits from agents Pankovitz and DeLock, our two interrogators, in which they respond to the allegations. As you will see, they say that the defendant mentioned a lawyer on a couple of occasions, but never specifically demanded one. He never stopped the interrogation. He wanted to talk." Stanley and his men scanned the affidavits. After a few minutes, Stanley said, "Okay. Point number two. The defendant claims he was repeatedly threatened with the death penalty by both agents. If true, this, of course, would be highly improper and would probably kill the confession." Westlake replied as he shook his head, "Look at the bottom of page 7, both affidavits. The agents state under oath that they made no threats whatsoever. These are very skilled interrogators, Stan, and they know the rules as well as anybody." Stanley and his men flipped to page 7 and read the text. "Perfect. Whatever Quinn claimed in his affidavit, there were two FBI agents willing to tell what really happened." Stanley said, "Looks good. The third point is that the agents promised the defendant he would not be put on trial for capital murder." "Page 9, Westlake said, "Our agents know they do not have the authority to make deals. Only the U.S. attorney can do that. Frankly, I find such an allegation ludicrous. Rucker is a career thug. He should know that prosecutors make deals, not cops."
I agree, Stanley said quickly. The next allegation is that the FBI agents threatened to prosecute other members of Rucker's family.
Don't they always say that, Stan? They give a confession, free and voluntarily, then can't wait to tear it up and say they were threatened. You've seen this many times. Of course Stan had, though he really had not. Westlake went on. Though I must say it wouldn't be a bad idea to round up all the Ruckers and give them the needle.
Westlake's men laughed. Stanley's men laughed. A regular party.
What about the allegation that the interrogators were abusive and pushed the suspect past the point of exhaustion?
Here's the truth, Stan, Westlake replied. The agents repeatedly asked Rucker if he wanted to stop and continue later. He said no, because he did not want to spend the night in the county jail. We checked and the jail was packed, badly overcrowded. They informed Rucker of this and he didn't want to go there.
This made perfect sense to Stanley. He said,
okay, the next three items need to be addressed. But I don't think we'll say much about them in our response. There is the allegation that the FBI agents lied about having a ballistics report that linked the murders to the Smith & Wesson handgun confiscated from the defendant. Unfortunately, as we now know, the ballistics excluded this weapon.
Lying is permissible, especially in a high-level interrogation such as this, Stanley. Westlake said, much like a wise old professor.
Got that. But just to satisfy my curiosity, did your agents actually lie about this?
Of course not. No, definitely not. Page 12 of their affidavits.
Didn't think so. What about this next allegation, that your agents lied about the existence of a crime scene boot print that matched some boots taken from the defendant?
Not true, Stan. The imagination of a desperate lawyer and his guilty client.
Do you have a boot print?
Westlake glanced at one of his agents, as though there just might be a boot print that he had somehow forgotten. The agent shook his head.
No, Westlake admitted. There's no boot print.
And next, we have the allegation that your agents lied about a couple of eyewitnesses. The first supposedly saw the defendant in the town of Ripplemead about the time of the killings. Any truth to this?
Westlake shifted his weight from one ass cheek to the other and offered a condescending smile.
Stan, look, I'm not sure you appreciate what it takes to break down a guilty suspect. There are tricks, okay? And
I get it.
And you have to instill fear to make the suspect think you have a lot more proof than maybe you actually have.
I've seen no report from such a witness.
And you will not. He doesn't exist.
We're on the same side here, Vic. I just need to know the truth so we can respond to the motion to suppress. Understand?
I understand.
And the second witness, the one at the country store near the cabin, he doesn't exist either, right?
Right.
Did the agents use any other tricks that I don't know about?
No, Westlake said. But no one in the room believed him.
So, to summarize our case against Quinn Rucker, we have no eyewitnesses, no ballistics, no boot print, no fingerprints, no physical evidence of any kind, correct?
Westlake nodded slowly, but said nothing.
We have a defendant who was in the Roanoke area after the murders, but no proof he was here beforehand, right?
More nodding.
And our defendant was caught with more cash than one would normally carry around. Substantially more, I would say.
Westlake agreed.
But then, Mr. Rucker is a self-confessed drug runner from a family notorious for trafficking, so cash would not be a problem.
Stanley shoved his legal pad away and rubbed his temples.
Gentlemen, we have a confession and nothing else. If we lose the confession, then Mr. Rucker walks and there's no trial.
You can't lose the confession, Stan, Westlake said. It's unthinkable.
I have no plans to lose it, but I can see the judge taking a dim view of the interrogation. The length of it bothers me. 10 hours throughout the night. An obviously fatigued suspect who's a seasoned crook and would probably want to see a lawyer. 2 veteran interrogators who know all the tricks. This might be a close call.
Westlake listened with a smile, and after a long pause said, "Let's not forget our star witness, Stan. Malcolm Bannister will testify that Quinn Rucker talked repeatedly of murdering Judge Fawcett. He wanted revenge, and he wanted his money back."
True, and his testimony plus the confession will get a conviction. But standing alone, his testimony is not enough.
You don't sound too confident, Stan.
Quite the contrary. This is the murder of a federal judge. I cannot imagine another federal judge showing any sympathy for Quinn Rucker. We'll have the confession, and we have Malcolm Bannister. We'll get a conviction.
Now you're talking.
By the way, what's up with our boy Bannister?
Safe and sound, buried deep by the U.S. Marshals.
Where is he?
Sorry, Stan. Some things we cannot talk about. But have no worries. He'll be here when we need him.
Chapter 23. Pat Suroff's replacement is Diana Tyler. I meet them for lunch after a long morning at the hospital where I was examined and was told to return in a month. Miss Tyler is a tall, pretty woman of about 50. With a short haircut, little makeup, a navy blazer, and no wedding band. She's pleasant enough, and over salads gives me her spiel. She lives in the area and works with a few others who share my situation. She is available 24/7 and would like to have a chat by phone at least once a week. She understands what I'm going through and says it's natural to keep looking over my shoulder. With time, though, those fears will go away, and my life will become quite normal. If I leave town and they stress this is something I can now do whenever I want, she would like the details of my trip in advance. They want to keep close tabs on me until long after I testify against Quinn Rucker, and they persist in painting the picture of a safe and pleasant future that I will know one day, when all of the initial hurdles have been cleared. They mention the 2 job interviews, and I throw a curve by explaining I'm not ready for employment. With cash in the bank and unrestrained freedom, I'm just not ready to start a new career. I want to travel some, take long drives, and maybe go to Europe. Traveling is fine, they agree, but the cover works best if I have a real job. We decide to talk about it later. This leads to a conversation about a passport and an updated driver's license. Another week and my face should be ready to be photographed, and Diana promises to arrange the documentation. Over coffee, I give Pat a letter to my father. The return address is the Federal Correctional Facility in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He will send it to the prison there, and someone will mail it to Henry Bannister in Winchester, Virginia. In the letter, I explain to old Henry that I screwed up at Frostburg and have been busted back to a regular prison. I am in solitary confinement and can have no visitors for at least 3 months. I ask him to notify my sister Ruby in California and my brother Marcus in D.C. I tell him not to worry. I'm fine, and I have a plan to work my way back to Frostburg. Pat and I say our farewells. I thank him for his courtesies and professionalism, and he wishes me well. He assures me my new life will be rewarding and secure. I'm not sure I believe this, because I'm still looking over my shoulder. I strongly suspect the FBI will monitor me for some time, at least until the day when Quinn Rucker is convicted and sent away. The truth is, I cannot afford to trust anyone, including Pat Suroff, Diana Tyler, the U.S. Marshals Service, and the FBI. There are a lot of shadows back there, not to mention the bad guys. If the government wants to watch me, there's little I can do. They can obtain court orders to snoop into my bank account, to listen to my phone calls, to monitor my credit card activity, and to watch everything I do online. I anticipate all of the above, and my challenge in the near future is to deceive them without letting them know they are being deceived. Taking one of the two jobs would only allow them another opportunity to spy. During the afternoon, I open another checking account at Atlantic Trust and move $50,000 from the Suncoast account. Then I do the same thing at a third bank, Jacksonville Savings. In a day or two, once the checks have cleared, I will begin withdrawing cash. As I putter around the neighborhood in my little Audi, I spend as much time looking in the mirror as I do watching the road. It's already a habit. When I walk the beach, I check out every face I see. When I walk into a store, I immediately find cover and watch the door I just came through. I never eat in the same restaurant twice, and I always find a table with a view of the parking lot. I use the cell phone only for routine matters, and I assume someone is listening. I pay cash for a laptop, set up 3 Gmail accounts, and do my browsing in internet cafes using their servers. I begin experimenting with prepaid credit cards I buy at a Walgreens pharmacy. I install 2 hidden cameras in my condo, just in case someone drops in while I'm away. Paranoia is the key here. I convince myself someone is always watching and listening, and as the days pass, I fall deeper into my own little world of deception. I call Diana every other day with the latest news in my increasingly mundane life, and she gives no hint of being suspicious. But then, she would not. The lawyer's name is Murray Huggins, and his small Yellow Pages ad announces specialties in just about everything: divorce, real estate, bankruptcy, criminal matters, and so forth. Pretty much the same ham and egg routine we followed at dear old Copeland, Reed, and Bannister. His office is not far from my condo, and one look suggests the laid-back beach practice of a guy who comes in at 9 and is on the golf course by 3. During our first appointment, Murray tells me his life